All right, so we'll get started. So if you can hear this presentation, that means you are interested in the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program. This specific webinar is geared towards our minority-serving institutions. However, if you're from an institution that exists outside of that, we still welcome you to join in and listen. Today we are joined by two current Fulbright Scholar in Residence hosts, which I'll introduce in a moment. But to kick it off, my name is Sarah Krauser. I'm an outreach and recruitment specialist in our Houston office, and I focus on our institutional opportunities, such as the Scholar in Residence program. I'm joined today by my colleague, Kaylee Atwater, who is in our D.C. office. Kaylee, would you like to say hi?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Atwater. I'm a placement advisor here at IIE in D.C. I work with the Scholar in Residence program and then a few other programs at IIE, also with undergraduate exchanges. And I'm looking forward to talking to you today.
And also on the line, we have David Levin, who is a Senior Program Manager at the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs. David?
Hello, everybody, and thank you all for tuning in.
Great. And then for our two hosts that we have on the line, we do have Dr. Sharon Roberts from Xavier University of Louisiana. Dr. Roberts, are you on?
Yes, I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Welcome.
All right.
And then we are also joined by Stephen Wall from the Institute of American Indian Arts. Stephen?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. So you guys will get to hear from both of our panelists a little bit later in this presentation. I know they're happy to give you any advice on how to kind of bolster your application and prepare for those scholar residents to come to your campus. Throughout the presentation, that same chat feature you use, please feel free to utilize it to submit questions for us who work on the program as well as these panelists, and we'll get to that at the end. And this session is also being recorded, so please feel free. We'll make sure to send this out to everyone as soon as it is done. But without further ado, we're going to kick it off. And Kaylee, next slide. There we go. So as I said, we're going to start with a quick overview of the program. Kaylee will take us through the application components, any tools and resources that we have available to you as the applicants. Then we'll touch on those institutional profiles, followed by other opportunities in a Q&A. All right. So the Fulbright Scholar Program, as you may or may not be aware of, was established in 1946, and it was established to send U.S. academics and professionals overseas, as well as bring scholars and professionals from abroad to the United States. The program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it is administered by the Institute of International Education out of multiple offices around the United States. This program really has constantly been evolving. As you can see on the screen, the black and white photo is one of our first scholars to Burma, whereas on the right-hand side, we see a photo of one of our Arctic scholars on their grant. So the program has constantly been evolving. We're trying to make sure that we are really engaging with U.S. academics, both in the U.S. and overseas. Next slide, Kaylee. The Scholar in Residence program is a great opportunity as part of this suite of Fulbright programs, and it allows you as a host institution to bring scholars and faculty members from overseas to your campuses. We try and engage with campuses that may not have had the opportunity to host scholars or have had a strong international presence. This opportunity really helps you internationalize your campus and develop exchange courses moving forward. The scholars that you do bring to your campus primarily teach at the undergraduate level. However, on occasion, we have had some teach at that graduate level. So feel free to reach out to us with any questions about that. These scholars come for either a semester or a full academic year. It's really up to you as the institution applying to put forth what you're looking for. And it provides a cross-cultural international perspective for your campus. The application is made by the interested U.S. institution, so you as that U.S. host institution are the ones to start the application, and you will submit that through our online application system that called Slate, which Kaylee will discuss momentarily. Throughout any given point, we have about 900 Fulbright visiting scholars on campus around the U.S. every year. So what sets this program in particular apart from those other visiting scholars in the U.S. is that as an institution, you're driving this process, and that these scholars are really integrated in the campus and community life. So as we said, these scholars are teaching primarily a full undergraduate course load, whereas for the rest of those visiting scholars in the U.S., they're primarily researching across the United States. So that's really one thing that sets this program apart. Many times these scholars are really viewed as all-stars on the campus. They tend to be more visible and involved, not only in their department that is hosting them, but really across the campus. So they might give back to other organizations on campus. They might serve as advisors, things like that. So really the sky is the limit with how you want to get involved with the Scholar in Residence program. The application did open in March, and it has a deadline of November 1st. That's the first difference that you'll see on this slide if you've ever listened to one of our presentations before. So we did move the deadline back by 2 weeks, so we hope that does help you guys when you get back to campus in the fall to finish those applications. Our contact email is on this screen. It's sir@iie.org. So please, if you have a question that you don't get to ask today, please email us with any questions. David, did you want to offer anything else about this program and what makes it unique?
I think I would just add that it's unique in the sense that it's as Sarah is talking about, it's institutionally driven, and the whole idea is campus internationalization. So when you think about the scholar that's coming to your campus, and they're teaching courses, they're also engaged across campus doing a whole variety of things, so that they interact with students and with faculty beyond the specific classes that they're teaching. And then third leg in the stool is they're engaged with the community outside of the university to help the university around your the location around your university also gain from their perspective and sort of a give and take in terms of international understanding. So it really does help you as an institution internationalize what you're trying to do. I guess this Fulbright is different than most Fulbrights, as Sarah said, where most Fulbrights are individual, a student or a scholar, either traveling abroad or coming to the United States, in essence doing their own work, a researcher, a teaching assistant, whatever it might be. In the case of scholar residents, we want them obviously to gain from this experience, but the primary objective is what they're bringing to you and to your institution as part of this internationalization effort.
Perfect. Thank you so much. And going off of that, exactly what David was saying, the next slide really discusses those program benefits, as you can see on the screen. And David really hit the nail on the head. So we do hope you will consider utilizing these scholars to work on these outcomes and impacts that David was discussing. Sorry. Go ahead, Kaylee. All right. So in terms of institution served, as you know with this specific webinar, this one is geared towards minority-serving institutions. That's just one of the many kind of audience and institution groups that we're looking for. So on the screen, you can see the types of institutions that we are hoping to work with to help internationalize their campus. Outside of those MSI institutions, we are eager to work with community colleges, small liberal arts colleges, and rural colleges. Additionally, we do seek out applicants from art institutions as well as women's colleges. So really, as we said in the beginning, we're really looking to work with institutions that just might not have access to these opportunities to make sure that they can participate in the program. If your institution does fall outside of kind of this area, we do encourage you to consider still applying. However, perhaps you'll consider partnering with another local institution. One great example that we have had as part of the program is the University of Tulsa partners with Tulsa Community College. So we do get a lot of those partnerships coming through, and they make sure that they are ensuring that they're kind of meeting the components and the true kind of design of the program. All right. The next slide will go into last year's breakdown of institutions that were part of the program. So as you can see, the largest is made up of small liberal arts for this last year, but a lot of them, as you can see in the breakdown, do come from that minority-serving background. So we really want to encourage you to continue to apply. This program is really for you, and it is what you can what you need to make of it is what you can get out of it. David, do you want to offer any other insights into kind of trends you have seen within the program?
No, I think, you know, as Sarah said, the target groups have by and large remained the same. We've added a focus on rural colleges the last couple of years. But if you look at all the targeted institutions that we're talking about, the commonality is that we're reaching out to schools that typically are less engaged in international exchange and perhaps even less engaged in Fulbright, but also are serving minority audiences. So for that reason, you can imagine minority-serving institutions really are front and center in terms of the kinds of institutions that we're prioritizing relating to scholar residents.
Perfect. And then the last slide that I have before I pass it over to Kaylee is just to show you the most recent MSI institutions that we had to participate in the program this last year. So we do really try and engage with institutions and make sure that they are part of this process. So if you have any questions or want to reach out to any colleagues, please reach out to them. And I'm sure I will speak for the panelists on the line that if they're open to it, we can put you in touch with them if you have any questions that you might want answered. But please, again, just reach out to sir@iie.org, and we'll make sure to take it from there. With that, I'll pass it to you, Kaylee.
All right. Thank you, Sarah. And everyone, this is Kaylee again from DC. And since we do really want to focus today's session around hearing from our panelists, from Sharon and Stephen, I'll run a bit more quickly through these sections. So just a quick note on webinars. If you do want a bit more of an in-depth walkthrough of the application, then we will be having that a little bit later on in the summer. And then we'll actually have two additional last call webinars that almost serve as office hours. So that's when we invite applicants to ask any last minute questions before the proposal draft date and then before the final due date. So anyone listening in who's familiar with the application or went through the process in a past cycle, you'll see that we have a brand new application system this year. It's called Slate. It's great. It's easy to use. You'll see that some pieces of formatting have changed very slightly from last year, but the content itself does remain the same. So you'll see upon starting an application that there are some shorter application sections, so this application form that you see up on the screen here, and we're asking you here to enter text, use drop-downs, and then in the next few slides I'll be showing you where you'll be uploading a number of documents. One tip we like to give is that it's always helpful for institutions to get into the application early. Start clicking through. It'll help you get insight into what's being asked of you and just to get an overall sense of the components. I'd also recommend that you take a look at the Scholar in Residence application guidelines. I think that there will have that linked to later on in the slide if you want to take a look at the PowerPoint later on too. And those application guidelines really do walk through everything step by step with examples, with best practices, with a few FAQs also. So definitely take advantage of those. And then for these first sections of the application, you'll see on the screen the individual components. It's more basic sections. You'll mostly be writing names and contact information. I do want to highlight a few pieces here, though. So there are two contacts listed. One is the administrative official or anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. And then the other is the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we do defer to your institution as far as how it's made up to determine who the appropriate individual would be. We know that it really varies by institution. Regarding program dates, we're working pretty far in advance, so you'll actually be listing dates in the 2020 to 2021 academic year. And then we'll be talking about financial support and then named versus recruited scholars in a moment, but you'll list basic information here. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary. Gives our viewers a snapshot as to what your program entails. So it's really helpful if you use this section to highlight all major proposal pieces and really what you want the reviewers to be seeing and focusing on as they read your proposal. All right, next up we have the next section called the narrative. And in this part, and especially after the next slide, I want to ask our panelists for your feedback from your end, how it was to actually fill this out. So just getting you ready here that I'll be putting you on the spot in a moment. So this next section here is the narrative proposal. This is really the main essence of the application, and it's divided into two parts. So the first part, which we have on the screen here, is the institutional profile. That is 4 to 5 pages, or 7 to 8 if you are doubling the institutions or doing a joint proposal. Keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution, so this is really key to giving them a better idea of your institution and who you are. Things you'll see here in the institutional profile include just more basic information. What we like to recommend is that it can be helpful to, as you're writing the proposal, just break these pages down by section. So slotting a few paragraphs under the mission heading, for example, and then academic offerings, and then so on down the line. We've heard from various applicants and from the reviewers that really helps to guide the conversation and guide their approach to the proposal. So what we want to see is how your institution is set up, what you have in place, and also what you don't have in place, so we can see where an SIR could maybe fill in a gap or help complement what you already have on campus. You'll also be indicating your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives. So what do you hope to gain through hosting a scholar in residence on campus? David, did you have anything to add to this section?
I just would add that the part where you're telling us about your short and long-term objectives is really critical, because you're explaining to us what you're doing short-term, what you're doing long-term, and you're describing how the scholar residence would fit those objectives. So you're making a case for how would the scholar serve your campus, serve your community. We want to see that there's a match between what you say you're doing, what you say your needs are, and your description of the scholar that you'd like to bring to campus.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Thank you, David. And then the second part of the narrative proposal is where you show what the Scholar in Residence program is going to accomplish for you. And then this is where at the end I'll ask our panelists to chime in if possible. So first a quick run through of these different components. So within the oversight section, you're addressing who on campus will be responsible for working with the Scholar in Residence, and then for what. So you've already identified two contacts in that first section of the application, so that administrative official and then the faculty associate working with the academic programming. So this is where you can actually jump in further and give a little bit more background of those individuals, what they'll be doing with the scholar on campus. We've seen this section take various forms. We've seen it where there's just one or two faculty listed here. We've also seen it where there's a whole Fulbright steering committee that pulls in staff from different departments or backgrounds. And again, we really do defer to you. What works for one institution won't necessarily work for others. So happy to talk through any pieces of this if you'd ever like to, though. Then we have the academic program of the scholar. So this is where you're saying what qualifications or background the scholar should have to meet the proposal's needs. Also talking about the need for the courses themselves. We often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus. So we see about an average of 2 per semester. And then sometimes the scholar might be teaching a course that's already designed, just providing international insight into that existing curriculum. But then there's other times where the scholar might be creating an entirely new course. So make sure you're highlighting these pieces in your proposal, because if they're creating an entirely new course, that might take a little bit more time than assisting with an existing course. So this is all the type of thing that the reviewers take into account during their discussions. Be sure to discuss how the scholar would interact all across campus, even across the community, because as Sarah was saying earlier, The goal of the program is to really maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. There's also professional enrichment in this section of the narrative. This is an institutionally driven application and program and proposal, but we also do want to see that there's potential for the scholar's individual growth. For sustainability, focus on how you would sustain the scholar's activities after they leave. This also lends itself to those long and short-term goals. And then the financial support. So this is where, in that first section of the application, you had listed just the base amount. And this is where you can expand on that also. Cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively of ways that they can provide this, but it's not required. It will not make or break an application. You won't be disqualified. What this looks like typically, though, is salary supplement or in-kind support. And then, David, did you actually want to talk a little bit about what kind of in-kind support we've seen or in the past?
Sure. We've seen a number of things that schools have offered. Maybe it's a meal ticket to the dining hall. Maybe it's some travel to enable the scholar to accompany American College to a professional conference. We've seen memberships at local museums. We've seen assistance with not necessarily paying for housing, but a housing service that would help someone find housing. We've seen activities that would benefit the family, even everything as much as ESL programming for children. So there's a variety of ways that you could think about, enhancing your application with some kind of in-kind support. We also do see on occasion, and I guess fairly frequently, in fact, although as Kayla said, not required, where schools have said we can actually provide some actual funding that would augment the actual Fulbright grant itself. And I've seen everything in a given year in terms of the actual funding support ranging from zero to $50,000. So it really is sort of across the waterfront, and as Kelly said, it's not going to make or break an application if you can't do that, but we'd like to, we encourage you to think about the ways that you might be able to do that.
All right. Thank you, David. And then I think that it would be wonderful to hear from Stephen and from Sharon about, if not building the proposal out itself, how different pieces of this are now working on campus for you. And I'm sorry, if you'll be talking about this later, you can always let me know. But yeah, Stephen, did you want to start out?
Yeah, I think that, looking at this, I'm going to kind of look at the narrative proposal. The slide before the one that's showing right now, the first slide on the proposal, the long and short-term internationalization goals and objectives. We started from there. Our program we requested support from Fulbright because we had entered into an exchange agreement with the Universidad Intercultural del Estado de México. And it's very similar to our school, in some ways, mainly because of the cultural components. But we started off trying to figure out how can we strengthen that arrangement. We had some of our students go down to Mexico for a number of summers. We've had one group of people from UIM coming up for one summer. We've had some of their faculty visit to look at program design for developing an art program. And then this fall, we're going to have our first students come up for a semester exchange. And we thought that the Fulbright, that was our starting point. And we thought, well, how can we, enhance this agreement? And so we saw the Fulbright as a possibility for that. We were able to request a specific professor. And in our agreement, there's two agreements here, basically. We had the Fulbright agreement, but we also had the exchange agreement with UIM. And so we brought Miguel up from UIM, We provided him a meal ticket for 19 meals a week for two semesters. We were going to help him find a place, but at the third weekend in August in Santa Fe's housing, it's very, very hard to come by. And so we ended up one of our family housing units became available, so we moved him in there. He paid the rent for it, but we did move him in there. He stayed on campus. Originally, the plan was that he would teach two Spanish classes a semester, and then the second semester he wanted to teach a class on linguistics, so he put together a class on linguistics for the second semester, and then he also audited classes in our creative writing department and in our liberal studies department. And so actually when we look back, and we were very, very lucky to get Miguel, because he was very, very ambitious about getting stuff done, including his own work. He's a linguist, and he's looking at the process of naming things. And so he did a study of street names in Santa Fe, and chased down the linguistic group for the various street names to see the cultural impacts from different cultures in Santa Fe. So this was really, really something. It was really a wonderful experience. We had him also accompany students. We have the tribal college movement has a thing called the every year American Indian Higher Education Consortium sponsors student competitions and a whole variety of things from academics to sports to art. And Miguel went with our students. He was one of our they call them chaperones. And he thought that was really, really neat. He wants to do something like that in Mexico with the intercultural colleges there in Mexico. So there's a lot. We had him for two semesters. Just yesterday, the faculty council voted to create a classification called affiliated professor, which really is in name only, but it's a policy that establishes that a person will maintain affiliation with the school even though they've returned back to their home school. And so we created that position and then immediately passed a resolution making Miguel an affiliated faculty with IAIA because of his contributions to our school. So we had an incredible experience with our scholar.
Thank you so much, Stephen. And I think I speak for all of us when I say that we love not only working with you through the application process, but actually hearing these stories from you is just so, so meaningful. And with those short and long-term goals, just hearing the way that you are reaching them also is great. So I think that it will be nice for our attendees and for the audience to be able to pick your brain a little bit and ask you some questions about that process on your side and how you're also talking about how you went about selecting the scholar. I'll actually be talking about that in a moment too. But I do want to hand this over to Sharon also quickly before we move on to that. So thank you again, Stephen. And Sharon, did you have anything that you wanted to add about this section?
Hi, Kaylee. I can wait till my presentation comes because sort of have it built in there.
No problem. Thank
yeah.
you.
Okay.
All right, perfect. Okay, so then, as Stephen was alluding to, moving into this next section after the narrative portion, and this is where we want to hear more about the scholar that you wish to bring. So the program allows for two different tracks, either naming a scholar or asking for recruitment of a scholar. And again, we'll be hearing from our panelists in a moment about the routes that they took. And for naming a scholar, you can actually name a scholar in your proposal that perhaps a faculty member has been working with in the past or that you have some kind of connection to, maybe met at a conference. So if you name a scholar, outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular grant. We ask that you submit a CV, two letters of recommendation, one of which should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus to primarily teach. You'll also want to be sure that they have the required English skills or language skills to teach that topic on campus. If you don't have a specific scholar in mind or have those connections in place, then that's fine. That's no problem. You can request the recruitment of a scholar. If you go by this route, then you'll be able to choose two different countries within one world region. Those regions are listed on our website. And if you don't see the country of interest or the country that you're interested in on the list, just reach out to us and we'll be happy to kind of walk through options with you. So in the proposal, you'll include information about the type of scholar you want us to recruit. We use these details to reach out to our colleagues abroad to see if they're able to recruit a scholar within that discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So the more information that you're able to provide here, the better it will be for the recruitment process for us. So if your institution requires a certain amount of teaching experience before they can teach on your campus, or if there's degree requirements, really anything that will help us to narrow down our recruitment efforts. David, did you have any input on recruiting versus naming a scholar?
Sure. So a typical question we would get in a given year is does it make a difference in terms of my application whether I actually name a scholar or ask for recruitment? And the answer is no. Either is perfectly fine. I would say in general, probably 60 to 70% of the requests that come in are in fact for named scholars, and that's fine. But it, like I said, it can work either way. The one thing I would say, if you are naming a scholar, it's important that it's not something based on some, casual relationship, casual acquaintance, that you're able actually to address the scholar's ability to teach, the courses that you'd like them to teach, and also that they're fluent in English because they're teaching at the college level and engaging, with your local community. So that's important, that it's not simply we met someone or someone even reached out to us and said, I'd like to come to your campus, and the process moved forward from there. It should be more substantive than that, that you've had a relationship, whether you as an institution or one of your faculty members, that can really speak substantively about, the scholar that you're looking to invite.
Perfect. All right. So then the one of the last sections here of the institutional application are the letters of support. So these are a number of uploads that you'll be uploading to the application itself. And these would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. So at a minimum, you'd need to upload a letter of support from the administrative official just saying, yes, we approve for the scholar to come on campus and when. There is no maximum. You can seek out letters from different departments across your institution, even neighboring institutions, if you want to co-host a lecture series, for example, have them go out to local clubs or organizations or high schools. We've really seen it all across the board. I will say that if you're including a letter of support, this isn't setting it in stone necessarily. It's more so just showcasing the excitement of having that scholar in residence on your campus and in the larger community. So this can also grow. So you're not just bound to only these letters of support. You can also involve the scholar in other pursuits once they've arrived. And then you'll also be uploading sample syllabi or course outlines. We just want to see what the proposed courses entail, get a sense of what it's about. If you have a specific scholar in mind, you might already have insight into what specifically they're able to teach and craft it in a way that will enhance that scholar's background and cultural perspective. This also may change, so you're not necessarily setting this course in stone by including it in the application, but it's just a sample of saying, this is what we'd like the scholar to teach, and this is how we plan to have them involved on campus. Okay, so once you move forward with your application, click Submit by November 1st, you might be curious as to what the review committee is looking for during review. So this is after you submit. I'd say to ensure that all pieces of your application are working together to give a real picture of what you're hoping to accomplish through hosting a scholar in residence. So short and long-term goals are this, and hosting a scholar in residence will contribute to these goals. We already discussed most of these when we were looking at the application components, so just to hone in on a few pieces, you'll want to think through if the proposal is feasible within the time period. You'll want to expand as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement. And then really take the time to think through that sustainability element. You've been hearing us talk about this a few times through this presentation, so are other professors sitting in and learning about what the scholar is teaching and try to help sustain it, things like that. And again, when we hear from our panelists in a moment, we'll be able to see these pieces in action. Okay, and now Sarah, I think I'm handing it back to you here for the actual review process and timeline.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Kaylee. And we'll go through this real quick. So one added benefit that we always like to discuss and about the SIR program that you don't necessarily see on other Fulbright programs is the fact that we encourage institutions to submit a draft proposal that we review and provide feedback on. So ahead of that November 1st deadline, on October 1st, that is our proposal draft deadline. So up until October 1st, you can submit your draft proposal statement. Our team will take a look at it, we'll review it, get it back to you, so you can make those changes ahead of that November 1st final deadline. If you do not have that draft proposal before October 1st, you're still more than welcome to reach out to us. We'll try and offer feedback in order as much as we can to help you bolster that application, but we do want to make you aware of that kind of specific action item that we can do to help you guys ensure that you are submitting a competitive application. After that November 1st deadline, it does go into a review process. So in December, we do have our external review committee that will review it and make those final decisions. In January, your institution will get notified of the review outcome. From January through April, there's kind of a lot of moving pieces going on. ECA, as well as the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, reviews those proposals separately and offers their feedback. And while they're doing that, IIE is confirming that institutional funding piece. Outside those, if you have requested recruitment for a scholar, we do send that information overseas to that poster commission, and they'll start to look for a scholar that fits that bill that you put forth. Whereas if you did name a scholar, we will confirm to make sure with, again, that posting commission that they are available to accept that funding. So that's kind of the timeline. Lots of moving pieces from January to April. And then from April to June, it should be confirmed. You know you're getting that scholar. You know when they're arriving. We send the grant packets to those grantees. And then either in the fall or the spring, whenever you have requested for that scholar to start, they will arrive on your campus. Next slide. As Kaylee alluded to earlier, we do have application resources. We do have that guideline walkthrough. After this recording is archived, I will be sending in a follow-up email letting you know the link to the archive, as well as I will attach a link to that scholar guideline. So you can download that, print it, and just kind of have it at the ready as you are completing the application. But all of our links are on our website, as well as scholar stories, but in order to kind of give you scholar story and institutional stories now, we're going to now pass the reins over to Dr. Sharon Roberts, who will talk about her experience hosting at Xavier University. Sharon?
Hi, can everyone hear me?
Yes.
So I want to share about our experience. Our road to hosting a scholar in residence wasn't a very smooth one through the process because we named the scholar initially and we had to change our scholar from the initial start to now. So the program, I would definitely encourage everyone to stick with it because the Fulbright program has been flexible to work with us as we had to put forward another scholar during the course of our process to hosting one. So that was one thing that was unique to our experience, and so that's one encouraging part of participating and applying. So I'm with Xavier University. We're a historically black university in New Orleans, And this year we hosted Professor Lionel Fanon from the State University of Haiti in Port-au-Prince. He was a named scholar, and to piggyback to what was said earlier, if you go to the next slide, he came to us actually from a university that we collaborated well with, which is Tulane University, and the Haitian studies professor there, this was a good colleague of his at the State University. We specifically wanted someone from the main university in the country. And so when our first named scholar was unable to come, we were able to replace him and make adjustments to the original proposal to have this second named scholar come. And so one of the main things that I want to point out is that we selected the country and the scholar because we identified shared experiences and goals and outcomes between our institution being in New Orleans and an institution that's in Haiti. We identified Haiti recovering and its education system, both university and public education system, its tourism economy recovering from the earthquake, and similar experiences for New Orleans and how our institution tries to serve our community to recover from Hurricane Katrina. So we identified what we shared in common with institutions where our scholar was coming from, and what we can exchange could be mutual as we sort of engaged our scholar and that they engaged our city and our campus. Let me see if I go to the next slide after that. Yes, you can go to the next slide. So after we also considered what were some of the primary resources that our community shared in common. You look again at the image of New Orleans on the left and Jacques Mel Haiti on the right, and both the cultural aspects of both of our places share a similar DNA, and what our institutions do to serve the community, what our students do as future employers of in our community, both our communities, these were things that I outlined as why a scholar from Haiti would be a best fit for a historically Black institution in New Orleans. We can go to the next slide. After that, I wanted to think about ways in which we could best use our scholar. What was unique to us is because we changed our name scholar. We had Professor Senon for just the spring semester instead of the entire year. And so I served as the academic point of principal contact. And so he was primarily structured in our African American and Diaspora Studies courses. Now that course, every student at our HBCU must take a course on the Diaspora or Black Studies, and this is something that is similar for many Black universities. There is a required African American or Black Diaspora Studies course, and so that was an easy way to maximize it to as many students as possible. And to make his load full, he was placed primarily in my class, but he was scattered across several classes, several African-American diaspora studies classes. But we kept his load in a way that he was always having those 3 hours a week, but in different classes. So he taught African-American diaspora study classes, and then he taught classes within his own disciplines. And the nice thing about the scholar that we had, although he was based in education and education policy in Haiti, his secondary area was linguistics and culture. And so he had a nice interdisciplinary range that took him all the way from literature to community and culture to tourism that allowed us to plug him into several different classes. So he was scaffolded between our Latin American studies classes, our language classes. We have a freshman class that introduced you to New Orleans. He was able to go to many classes and talk about different types of topics in his own areas of expertise. And so we maximized him above our freshman students, our upper class students, as well as students in between for other classes. And one of the photos that you see is him meeting with the head of the education program at our university, which just received a multi-million-dollar grant from the Department of Education to have better outcomes in New Orleans public schools. It is one of the first all charter school districts. And so he's also working on initiatives in Haiti to have rural education come up to a different level and also to fix problems in urban and inner-city education in Haiti. So both of them have spent a good amount of time in the community, in public schools, learning about the challenges for education for black children. So to the next slide, in terms of building a schedule for your scholar in residence, we're fortunate in New Orleans that we have a very robust calendar of activities. And so I pulled from our calendar of activities and had him naturally built into it. So I put a call out to the community, and we had the Film Society. They had a special Francophone film festival happening in February. His first weekend he was here, he was talking at the film festival that drew a large community crowd. For Mardi Gras, obviously, we just tapped into our second year of a Haitian parade within Mardi Gras, and he was there, and he spoke at it. You can see images of him there. So almost every week, the community was able to use him as a resource for people who came to visit us, for people across the state of Louisiana, and then just for our old residents who were interested in these things. And a lot of the talks that he was able to give to the community, he was able to educate them about Haiti's influence in the cultural practices in New Orleans. The other thing that I found in the next slide that was very, I think, very impactful is that there was the launch of a Haitian community center happening at the same time that he was here. And this was because I had developed a relationship with the Haitian community. I've also developed relationships with colleagues at the State University in Haiti. And so the Haitian community here, they were launching the center. They wanted his feedback on how to launch the center. So he worked with them during the time that he was there. And coming closer to Jazz Fest, we had one of the most renowned Haitian bands, Bookman Experience, visit our city. And we, alongside the Haitian Community Center that was launching, they put together an exhibit, a community talk that featured Haitian metal artist exhibits that can be seen in the metal work along the French Quarter in New Orleans. So the talk was called Haiti is Us, and Professor Sanon was a part of that community panel with Bookman Experience and other folks who work on Haiti's influence in New Orleans, and that was a well-attended event that we recorded the entire thing. We have it now to always keep and show. So his work with the community center has been really helpful in helping them figure out ways to support the community that we have here in the city. And then the next slide sort of shows sort of how I structured this in my narrative proposal. You know, and I think what was described earlier about the narrative section, you could find ways to kind of break it out. So I talked about public education, working with other universities. He's given lectures in all of the universities here in the city. Once they knew that he was here, because different universities have Latin American studies programs, so he spoke with these different universities. He's been part of the Neighborhood Story Project, which has gone to Haiti and Jack now. So he's working with the University of New Orleans, which is our public university, to help them on that project. And both Xavier and UNO are co-listed for a book project that we're producing from him being here and being able to bring his expertise to this Jack Mill project, because this Jack Mill project connects back to New Orleans history. The city activities, I spoke about that earlier. And then the community groups. These are the Haitian Community Center groups. At that time, they didn't have that name, now they have a name, and so I anticipated these, and this is how I documented it in the narrative. The next slide, I talk about sustainability. One of the things that he helped to do was to help draw interest into our Latin American studies at Afro-Latin American Caribbean minor. The numbers in that minor program has doubled since he's been here, to help generate interest into our study abroad. Now we have more students looking to find opportunities to go to the region, to support faculty to get contacts if they want to do work in Haiti. He's met with faculty in several different departments and helped them connect to colleagues at his institution. He's worked with our Confucius Institute, and then he's also worked with our administration on a memorandum of agreement of understanding between our university and the State University of Haiti. One of the things that we put in our overview of our university in identifying a scholar from Haiti is that the founder of our university, St. Catherine Drexel, her order of nuns also founded public schools in Haiti. And so we want to ensure that we continue that mission and legacy from our institution. And then the last two slides I want to go through is just the outcomes. I shared an image of one of the students in the Latin American Studies class providing a birthday cake for Professor Sanon. And many of our students actually took Professor Sanon and his wife, who's in the photo, and she took an English language class at the University of New Orleans, and our university supported that. They took them to the Whitney Plantation. They helped them see New Orleans through their eyes. So they had a very intimate experience with them. This is the professor at the Whitney Plantation, of which many of the slaves there came from Haiti historically. And then in the last slide, I wanted to share a feedback from a student who was not a major, but who wrote in her evaluation to a public health teacher that her second favorite class, she's graduating, she graduated, and her second favorite class was my Latin American Studies class. And in the last sentence, she said, we had a guest professor from Haiti who have, who gave us firsthand insight of what it was like in a Caribbean nation. And so it was really nice to see in a survey that was not connected to the class that a student who was graduating actually noted that experience with the scholar in residence as being a standout education experience for them in their 4 years here. So that's kind of a roundup of what it was like having Professor Sanon from the State University of Haiti this semester at Xavier. That's it.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Erin. With that, I want to also give Stephen time. I know, Stephen, you went over it a little bit earlier in the presentation, but to talk about your experience as a whole.
Okay. You know, Institute of American Indian Arts is one of the tribal colleges here in the United States. It's one of, I think, four that are intertribal in nature. Most tribal colleges are specific to the reservation that they're located in, and their educational programs are designed around what's needed in those particular communities. We have about 400 students representing about 85 different tribes from across the United States and Canada, and we're a pretty small institution in that sense. We have one of the few colleges in the tribal college movement that actually try to do things internationally. We've had this agreement with UIEM that I mentioned earlier, and there's been a history of IAIA participating in cultural exchanges and this kind of stuff for the past and the school's only been around for about a little over 50 years, so during that time we've had a number of cultural exchanges. But we've never had an actual exchange that was more than a couple of weeks long. This fall, with the students coming up from UIM for a semester, and then this last two semesters having the scholar in residence from UIM, we're moving more and more into that international field. When we approached Fulbright approached us, I'm trying to figure out exactly which. As faculty here, I was more along the programming side, and then the Office of Sponsored Programs did a lot of the groundwork for our application. But I worked a lot with the person there, Lori Logan Brayshaw, and we put together the application, submitted it, and it was accepted. We didn't choose a specific scholar at first. We chose an institution, and the institution provided us names of potential faculty who could participate in the Fulbright. In our criteria, I had been down to UIM several times. I knew a number of people on faculty there. And when the choices came, what we ended up looking at was somebody who is young and has a whole lot of energy and would be around UIM for a while to help solidify and strengthen our exchange agreement with them and enhance our relationship with the school over a period of time. And I had no idea who, we got Miguel Reyes as our visiting scholar, and I had never met him, although I was supposed to have been on a panel with him at the Comparative and International Education Society meeting in Mexico City, but due to a number of unforeseen situations, he was not able to participate. So I never got a chance to meet him until he came here. But we chose him based on mainly on his ability to enhance our relationship with UIM and strengthen our exchange programs. When he got here, we had not put together a really strong program for him. We have never had a Fulbright. We didn't know what was expected in terms. It's one thing to say what's expected. You look at the list and you say, okay, well, we're expected to do this. It's another thing to actually sit down and make it happen and figure out what this program really involves. And so when we brought Miguel in, the first things we had him to do was teach two classes in Spanish. And that was about all we had planned, except we knew that he had his own personal research he wanted to complete. And what we found out, though, was that Miguel also wanted to do a lot of other stuff. So he participated in our open house. We have an open house every year, and he ran a thing called the Soul Cafe. And he did that two or three other times here on campus and in the community of Santa Fe. He later began to teach classes in our continuing education department. And the classes that he taught were Mexican history and culture, two or three classes there, and then a class on linguistics, kind of giving people an overview of the field of linguistics within our continuing ed. That was an outreach totally out to the community of Santa Fe. His classes were full, and they were primarily made up of people who were not affiliated with IAS students, faculty, or staff. So that was a real nice thing that he did for us. He did do study that he wanted to do. He was able to get that completed. He also traveled quite a bit here in New Mexico and Arizona, and spent a lot of time guest speaking in classes, and accompanied the students to Billings, Montana for the AHEC conference, which was a real eye-opener for him. He was amazed at the nature of the tribal college movement and how students are so involved. He likes that idea, is wanting to do something like that down in Mexico. We had, when he came, he was originally just going to teach those two classes and do his research, but he quickly also decided to take classes while he was here. And the first semester he audited the indigenous aesthetics class, the upper division class that we had. And then in the second semester he audited an intro to poetry class, as well as teaching. And so he was very, very busy while he was here and did a lot of really wonderful things for the school. Just we had a going away party for him, and everybody was just sad that he was leaving and appreciative of all the work that he had done to help here at IA. And, but there's, I think as I look back on this, reflect back on this process, there's a couple of things I think that we probably could have done better. And that is some of the pre-planning of activities. But, you know, you never can tell. You know, we know that we now know that Fulbright people come here with work to do of their own, but they also want to contribute to our community and to our institution. So we have to make sure that that happens in an organized way. We were very lucky to have a self-starting young man who was going to be our scholar in residence. We would have gotten a lot out of it, out of the whole experience, Fulbright experience, but I also feel that we could have been a little bit more structured in terms of how we approached his activities in the community at large and the IA community as well. But because of who he was, he filled in the gap very quickly. I think in terms of sustainability, I mentioned that thing about creating the affiliated faculty position and then resolving to make him the first of the affiliated faculty. That's one aspect of it. I think in terms of his impact here on campus, I'm not too sure. I mean, he taught all of our, we only have two Spanish classes, and so he taught both of those, and students really enjoyed his presentations on special days. In Mexican history, he would open up his class for everybody to come in for a kind of a cultural presentation. That won't be replicated, and trying to figure out how to maintain the sustainability of our relationship with Miguel is one thing. I think the sustainability of the Fulbright experience as a whole and future and our ability to participate in future Fulbrights is something that's important.
Yeah.
I think also that, you know, one of the things that we did find out was that the scholars and residents have a lecture, the ability to go to other schools and to lecture. And we did bring a young lady from India to IAIA to present an art history lecture, very, very apropos for our school. So that may be something that we continue on with the program.
Yeah, and I know that this is Kaylee. I know that Sarah is also going to talk in a moment about that, the lecturing opportunity, that short term that you were mentioning. And it really is helpful hearing from you, because just hearing how hosting a scholar in residence really helped you build out processes on campus, and hearing you before talking about those short and long term goals and kind of how a scholar in residence fits into that, really goes a long way and is helpful for our attendees to kind of get into your mind as you're going into this process, Stephen. And how with that named versus recruited, just our team and IAE and everyone, we're happy to kind of talk through all of these different routes. So Stephen, you were saying that you kind of picked an institution and helped us gear the search that way as opposed to naming a specific scholar. And then also hearing how, from both of you, that the scholars' field of study, while it may be one piece, they were actually involved in many, many, many activities. And I think that scholars on campus often find themselves as Sarah was calling them, superstars, and just kind of helping out with all a number of pieces on campus and in the larger community. And that really helps with their professional development, too. Sarah, I know that we are a little short on time, and I'm sorry, Stephen, to cut you off. was there anything else that you needed to run through to at the end here?
Sure. I can just quickly do the last two slides and then pass it back, and I think there's just two questions I've seen come in. And then obviously, if you have something else you want to add, we can definitely allow for that. But the one thing we want to get across, Kaylee mentioned this, is we do have upcoming webinars. They're all on our website, so please feel free to register for them. The next one we have is Thursday, focusing on the small liberal arts colleges. And as Kaylee mentioned, we will have that application walkthrough. I think it is a very critical webinar to attend, to hear from Kaylee kind of each step, and she goes live through the system, as well as those two last call webinars for any last-minute questions. As Stephen did mention, the Outreach Lecturing Fund is another wonderful opportunity that really goes hand-in-hand with the Fulbright Scholar in Residence Program. With the OLF, this allows you to invite any current visiting scholar here in the U.S., so those 950 scholars, inclusive of those SIR scholars that are currently in the U.S., you can invite to your campus for a short-term basis to lecture 2 to 6 days. We will be launching our OLF Summer Fest this week, so if anyone does have interest in participating and hosting a scholar during the summer, because they are still here, please email me at olf@iie.org. And with that, Kaylee, do you want to... should we get a question real quick?
Sure. While we're pulling open the questions, David, if there's anything that you wanted to add to.
Just that I was really, really impressed by that, by our two campus representatives talking about really how the programs work for you and how it's made an impact on your campus. And I mean, that's exactly what we love to hear. The way that you know, you're utilizing the scholar and also giving the scholar the chance to do their own kind of research and so forth. And this is exactly, you know, what we would love to hear. This is exactly why this program is so impactful, because it does really have a way of integrating itself into the campus and the community. So I'm appreciate that and I think that's great.
Thank you.
Agreed. You should, in the DC office here, we're smiling as we're going through all of the slides and hearing our panelists talk. So thank you so much. Sarah, I can answer these questions here that are coming in, if that's all right.
All right.
Okay. So it looks like we have one where it's a question about the criteria for selecting institutions for hosting the Scholar in Residence. So is the Scholar in Residence in the U.S. or in other countries? So we do have criteria on our website. If you go into the links that Sarah had included on this PowerPoint, then you can take a look there to see eligibility criteria on our website. And then also there was a slide in this PowerPoint talking about review criteria. And that review criteria really does pull from different pieces of the application and kind of breaks it down. So the stronger the application, and as you're looking through those application guidelines, I think the more you'll meet those review criteria. And then as for eligibility, this the institutions who can apply to host a scholar in residence must be U.S. institutions. Okay. Then there's also a question about the minimum course load that the visiting scholar would need to have while on campus. David, did you want to take this one about expected course load?
Sure. So I think on average, assuming that you're asking for a scholar for the academic year, I think it's typically 2 courses a semester. But having said that, some schools might say maybe it takes the scholar a little bit of time to acclimate to the new culture and the new institution and so forth. So some schools might say, we'll have them teach 1 course, perhaps, let's say, during the fall semester, maybe some guest lecturing, and then increase that to 2 courses during the second semester when they're more acclimated and so forth. So it's really up to you, but we do see a number of schools that sort of have this sort of ramped up process from one semester to the second.
Sarah, was there anything else out here?
I don't see any other questions that have come through, but always, I always like to say, email us if you have questions. If you have any questions for any of our panelists today, I'm happy to send them their way, get their feedback, and get back with anyone if they do have specific questions. But as David said, the advice both Stephen and Sharon you gave, it's just so tremendous, and we're just so grateful that you took time out of your day. I know you both are so very busy, so we do appreciate all the advice that you have given to our prospective applicants, and we look forward to working with you guys in the future as well.
You're welcome, Sarah.
All right. Well, with that being said, I guess we will end the webinar. Sorry we went over a little bit, everyone, but we do appreciate that you did stay on with us and are really eager, and I'm getting a lot of thank yous through the chat system. So, again, thank you, Stephen and Sharon. Thank you, David, for being on the line, and we look forward to working with everyone as you guys consider submitting this application. So we look forward to working with you. Have a good one.
Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
All right.